If something like this can happen in a country like New Zealand, I don't see how anyone can feel safe anywhere.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And today we reflect on a day of horror in New Zealand, the country's first mass shooting in nearly 30 years.
That is the city where I was born. That is the city where I became who I am. You know, my formidable years were there, and I just feel so violated.
Lamia Imam was at home in Austin, Texas, when she found out about an attack at her hometown mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand.
The mosque where the majority of the people died, that was the first mosque I ever went to as a baby.
Imam's family left New Zealand for several years, but she returned as a teenager.
I went to university in Christchurch, and it's a very peaceful, almost has a small town vibe to it.
That peace was shattered when a terrorist entered Al Noor Mosque on Friday and shot and killed 42 people before driving to another mosque 3 miles away and killing 8 more.
I saw it as breaking news when there was no information. And when I first saw it, I really kind of dismissed it because I did not think that something like this would ever happen in New Zealand. I was in such shock. I couldn't believe that that could even be true.
The carnage didn't square with Imam's memories of the mosque as a place that peacefully brought together people from so many backgrounds, where the sounds of English mixed with Hindi and Arabic. Imam says she's grateful that the people she knows in New Zealand are safe, but the attack on her community feels deeply personal.
It's one of those things where even if it's not your family or somebody you know, the community is so small. And if you've been to a place and see something like this happen, it feels like they are your family in a weird way. So some of the images that I was looking at, it's so heart-wrenching because even if it's faces I don't know, there are faces I would know, if that makes any sense. And so it still feels like it's your family.
Imam, who works at a tech company now, says the attack doesn't fit with her understanding of New Zealand.
You know, people don't really have guns. People don't talk about guns in New Zealand like the way they talk about it in America, because here in Texas, there's been towns here where armed hate groups have shown up to mosques, right, to intimidate people. And I have not gone to a mosque here in Texas since I've moved here. I would not go because I know people in Texas carry guns. I know that people open carry, and I know people conceal carry, and I'm terrified.
The attack has left her feeling that there's no place where she can practice her faith in peace.
It's so unexpected and so horrific because it just makes no sense and it makes you feel so unsafe. One of the things that I always think about living here in the U.S. is sometimes the violence that you see in the news makes you feel, hey, I could just leave and go back home and go back to New Zealand where it's safe, where nothing like this ever happens, where a country that's far, far away in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And then when you see a news like that, you realize there is really no safe place left. When leaders say things that fuel hatred in somewhere like the US or the UK or Europe, it's not just constrained to those places. People hear them everywhere.
Lamia Imam says she hopes to see stricter gun laws in New Zealand, and that looks like it will happen. But in the meantime, her heart is in her home country.
New Zealand is a really tiny country. We're a country of 4.5 million people, and people are really, really grieving and really sad. So I just want to say that I'm grieving with them.
Lamia Imam is a longtime member of the Al Noor Mosque in Christchurch, and she lives in Texas. Fifty people were killed in Friday's shooting in Christchurch, New Zealand, at two mosques. The victims range from 3-year-old Muka Abdi to 71-year-old grandfather Dawood Nabi. All of them were Muslim. Their deaths are part of an alarming pattern of white supremacist violence around the world, including here in the United States. Kathleen Ballou is assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago. She's also the author of the book Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. Kathleen, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So as I mentioned at the top, we're seeing this attack fit into other patterns of attacks we've seen in recent years, including here in the United States. I think Charlottesville, I think of Pittsburgh. How is it that this white supremacist violence is unfolding the way it is today?
Well, let's start out by thinking a little bit about our terminology. I think that We want to use a phrase to name this movement that is specific and concrete and that conveys the radical nature of the future imagined by these activists. And for that reason, I think we should think of this not as white supremacist or white nationalist violence, but as a coordinated social movement, the white power movement. And the reason I say that is that when we talk about nationalist violence, most people, I think about the nation as being the center of that term and assume that the nation means the United States. But for this group of people, and as we saw so clearly in the attacks in New Zealand, the nation imagined here is not the United States or New Zealand or Australia, where the gunman seems to be from, but rather this idea of a transnational Aryan nation, a white nation that is bounded together in common purpose. So what we see is the emergence of a transnational understanding that links different white countries together for these activists and creates kind of a world map of violent possibility.
I want to get into a little bit more of the specifics there. We're also now joined by Khalid Beydoun, who's an associate professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Khalid.
Thanks for having me.
So you have been tweeting about each of the victims since this attack happened, and you've also been receiving messages from family members and friends and victims of the attack. Why did you choose that approach? Why is it important to highlight each of these victims individually?
Well, I think what prompted me to keep a thread of the 50 victims was, you know, first I was doing media and I realized that there was a lot of fixation on the terrorist, his manifesto, his white populist vision, and no attention being paid to the individuals on the ground who were slaughtered by the terrorists. So being Muslim American myself and, you know, hearing a lot of frustration from members of my community, my family members, you know, I took it upon myself to try to give face, humanize the stories of the 50 individuals, to portray them, you know, more than just statistics or, you know, numbers that were rising, as more about the massacre was being learned, to try to convey the idea that these were real people with real families and real stories.
Another thing that we're seeing, Khalid, to Kathleen's point earlier, is this white power movement that's growing across the world. This attack, I'm wondering if you can tell us also a little bit about how this squares with the rise of Islamophobic violence specifically.
Yeah, so when I think of white supremacy or white populism, it's really critical to not think about it as, you know, a fringe movement, something that is aberrant or deviant. It's mainstream. It has a rich history. There's an underbelly that's rising to the fore. You have politicians, whether it be Donald Trump or this individual in Australia, Fraser Anning, who echoed the idea that it was immigration, right? It was Muslims that were the cause of the massacre. So you have this relationship, this bind, if you will, between the vigilante terrorists on the ground and the politicians who are feeding them with the rhetoric and the ideas that emboldens the kind of violence we see in New Zealand. And, you know, part of the white populist vision, obviously, is centered on anti-Muslim bigotry. They view Muslims as a rival civilization, a rival political ideology. And individuals like the terrorists on the ground in New Zealand feel as if, and they write in the manifesto, that they're launching a crusade against Muslims. So Islamophobia is central to this white supremacist, white populist vision.
Kathleen, I want to bring you in here. At the top of the show, we heard from Lamia Imam, who's a woman who lives here in the United States but attended this mosque. And one of the things that she said that was so powerful, and I'm quoting here, is that she says, when you're in a country that's far, far away in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and she basically says there's really no safe space left. And I'm wondering, she also mentions that when leaders say things that fuel hatred somewhere like the U.S. or the U.K. or Europe, that hatred, if you will, is not constrained to those places. Kathleen, can you help us understand a little bit about the influence that rhetoric, like what was cited by this terrorist of the president of the United States, how that impacts what we're seeing today?
Well, let me say this. I think that this is one place where history can really help us to understand what is happening. And one of the things that stood out to me and what the first person was saying was the phrase, it just makes no sense. And that's a common response to attacks like this. And it's completely understandable, especially for people who have deep ties to community like that. And I have to commend the work that my fellow panelist is doing in humanizing and bearing witness to this violence. But the thing that history can do here is precisely to help us make sense of what it is and what it means. And I actually think we want to be very, very cautious in sort of painting with the same brush political rhetoric that is doing some of the same symbolic work that we see in something like this Shooter's Manifesto and the on-the-ground acts of violence carried out by white power activists, which is a bounded and much more concrete sphere of this kind of ideology.
Can you give I was going to say, if you can tease that out a little bit,
yeah,
because
sure.
I think when we hear, you know, particularly when we hear and see the connections between this current administration and white supremacists and white power movement in the United States, it's hard not to make the link to what's happening abroad.
You're right. And I think we should be making that link. And I think there's a big conversation we need to have about the many ways that this kind of violence is enabled and given both tacit and direct acceptance by people in power and by institutions and by different spheres of our society. I think that that is very, very important. But let me say this. The last time that this movement turned to a wave of intense revolutionary violence in the 1980s, it was not under an administration that sought to contain it, but was rather under the second term of the Reagan administration. And having someone in power that activists on the fringe might have been assumed to see was sort of a compatriot in some ways, or at least they stood to benefit from the policies of the Reagan administration in some really concrete and material ways, that didn't contain this violence. And in fact, the activists on the fringe saw what they thought of as the comparative moderation of Reagan compared to the kinds of things that they wanted to do as a sort of a reason to declare race war. So what happens is sometimes when society as a whole sees politicians backing up this kind of violence with rhetoric or seeming to condone it, they think, aha, these fringe groups are going to be happy with this kind of an answer, and therefore we're going to see a decrease in violence, when in fact the opposite has been true historically.
Khalid, I want to ask you something we heard in the opening segment. Lamia Imam says there doesn't seem to be any safe space left. How do the politics of recent decades influence how people are feeling today, particularly Muslims who are looking for a safe space to live and pray?
So beyond the discourse, beyond the rhetoric from politicians, which might embolden violence, we have policy, right? So it's critical to understand that in this country, we have a standing Muslim ban. Right, so there's laws in place that demonize Muslims as being this enemy invader that we want to keep beyond our borders. And before the Muslim ban, we obviously had this protracted war on terror. It was built upon programs like government surveillance within mosques. So even though we think about religious spaces like mosques or synagogues or churches as being these purified places where individuals should expect safety, the fact that the state has penetrated these spaces, specifically mosques, in a very extreme way, and effectively branded them as spaces where individuals become terrorists and become radicalized, is signaling to private individuals, private terrorists, that you got to keep tabs on these mosques. You got to keep tabs on these individuals praying within these spaces, which then facilitates the possibility of something like a massacre that we saw in Christchurch taking place. So there's a direct connection between rhetoric, but there's also a nexus between policy that enables this kind of thing to happen.
Kathleen, I want to bring you back in because we were talking before the break a little bit about the history behind some of these movements. What about players like, for example, Steve Bannon, who has sort of, left the American military, the American political stage for the time being, if you will, and sort of taken off to Europe and beyond? Do folks like that have a direct influence on what we're seeing, or are those two separate schools of thought and ideology?
Well, I'm a historian, and I don't study the current moment in that way, but I think that the history here is very, very instructive. And from the beginning, this is a movement that has been transnational in character. And like most transnational phenomena, that means it's influenced both by inflows from other places. And we could look at, for instance, the influx of skinhead culture from Great Britain that gets instrumentalized and becomes a racist force in the United States in the late 1980s, and also direct exports efforts to other places via the internet, but also via, Aryan nations sent literature and publications to different places in the 1980s and 1990s. Groups like World Church of the Creator and Wotansvolk created chapters in different countries. So an activist in Australia would have been accessing this information and culture not only through websites, but also through reprinted newspapers, sending away for materials, listening to radio sermons, and also creating relationships with other activists. This is a social movement that's always been transnational in form and has decades and decades of experience in organizing.
And Khalid, I want to bring you in here because what impact does that have? I'm still struck with the phrase that there is no safe space. And I think a lot of us feel that way in our homes, in our countries, so whoever, those of us who are marginalized. So what can the community do, or what has the response been, if anything, to this increase in white power violence?
Well, I think part of the strategy of whether it be Trump, whether it be, these terrorists on the ground, is to intimidate Muslims from freely exercising their religion, from conspicuously expressing their Muslim identity, from being Muslim, right? They want people like my mom to rethink about her wearing the hijab when she steps out of the house. They want people like my two nieces who are college students to reconsider being part of the MSA, the Muslim Student Association, and to wear the hijab. That's kind of the long game, right? That's the long game of these terrorists. And to be frank with you, I think it's the long game of the Steve Bannons of the world I think it's critical to think about him as a bridge with what's taking place on the ground with white supremacists and trying to mainstream that movement to make it palatable, politically speaking, and to make it palatable to young people. And I think we see, you might want to call it an evolution of white supremacy, and I'm not an expert on this stuff, but if you look at what happened in Charlottesville, right, they're cleaning up the way they look. They look like, J. Crew sort of models on a magazine of some kind, right? So there's an aspiration and objective of white supremacists to move away from that skinhead sort of archetype into looking like your neighbors so they can become more palatable to the political mainstream.
Khalid Baydoun is associate professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law, and Kathleen Ballou is an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago and author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. Thanks, Kathleen, and thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Takeaway also got reaction to the terrorist attack from Paul Spoonley, a sociologist at Massey University in New Zealand.
Even though I've been doing research on the extreme right in New Zealand for almost four decades, the events of recent days when a ultra-right shooter entered two Christchurch mosques and shot the worshippers have been deeply unsettling. I've warned often of the potential violence of these groups, but to see it being realised is truly unsettling. And like all New Zealanders, we are having to rethink who we are and what defines us. It's a deeply unsettling moment in our country's history.
Spoonley says he's been warning the New Zealand government about the far right in the country for a long time. We also heard from Muhammad Nabil Musharraf of the Islamic Circle of Australia and New Zealand. He's based in Australia.
The whole community is in shock after this incident. New Zealand is a very peaceful country. Its people are very friendly and welcoming. So no one was expecting such brutality to have happened here. This has caused great trauma for the entire community. 49 families, at least, won't see their loved ones again. There are many others who are still in hospitals in critical condition. So it is indeed a moment of great tragedy, unmatched tragedy, in the history of New Zealand. We are all extremely sad about that.
Musharraf told The Takeaway that his community won't let hate divide the society.
That is what the terrorists wanted, but we won't let that happen. We'll continue to be the contributing members of the broader communities that we live in. Nothing can hinder us from that. At the same time, we are trying to help the families of the victims. Some of the charity organizations have established funds, but none of this help can fill the vacuum that has been created because of the lowly terrorist acts. We need support in that regard. We need our governments and our media agencies and our news channels to play a role in that. We all have to act as one against hate and the hate mongering, which leads to such tragic incidents.
That was Muhammad Nabil Musharraf of the Islamic Circle of Australia and New Zealand. And you also heard from sociologist Paul Spoonley of Massey University in New Zealand. You know those traffic cameras that automatically send you tickets when you speed or run a red light? Well, they might be helping Immigrations and Customs Enforcement track down and deport undocumented immigrants. Last year, ICE paid the private company Vigilant Solutions almost $6 million for access to a network of automatic license plate readers. And earlier this month, the ACLU got their hands on almost 2,000 pages of documents detailing how ICE is using that data to circumvent sanctuary city laws. On top of that, the technology itself has privacy advocates worried that the U.S. is becoming a surveillance state. Here to discuss what we learned about automatic license plate readers, or ALPRs, from the recent documents release is Dave Moss, a senior investigative researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Last November, he published a sweeping investigative report on license plate readers, and in the past few weeks, he's been helping the ACLU make sense of the new documents. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Hey, happy to be here.
So, automatic license plate readers, I thought those were things that cop cars had only as they were sort of driving and picking up everyone's license plate. How pervasive are they?
Oh, they're super pervasive. So yes, they're attached to police squad cars as they drive around, but they're also attached often to streetlights, highway overpasses. But there's also private companies that attach them to tow trucks, and those tow trucks go around collecting data as well. And then all of that is uploaded to a central database that allows you to go in and search not only the travel patterns of where a particular vehicle was, but also visitors to a particular location.
Can you tell us which federal agencies, like how many folks have access to these license plate databases? Because this isn't new technology, right?
Yeah, it would be very, I mean, it would be a lot easier to list off places that don't have it.
Okay.
But certainly the DEA has been infamous for its use of license plate readers. You know, Department of Homeland Security has license plate readers. Customs and Border Protection got caught a few years back putting a license plate reader in front of a gun show in
and
Carlsbad,
ICE has
California.
Them now, right?
Yeah, and that caused, you know, that's part of why we see some bipartisan concern around this, because it's not just the issue of collecting data on immigrants, but collecting data on everybody while in the pursuit of collecting immigrants.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, if I have a car and I obviously have a license attached to that, that information will then go to potentially in some sort of license plate reader. Is there a line between public and private consumption of that information?
You know, it's a bit tricky, sure, because we don't want to create legislation that bars people from taking photos in public. But at the same time, when it comes to the government entities, we don't want the government tracking us wherever we go. We don't want them to be able to put us on a hot list and then get alerts as we're moving about in our daily lives.
How does this particularly affect the immigrant population, particularly undocumented immigrants? What is ICE exactly doing that you've found so far?
So we don't actually know a whole lot, you know, and there's been a lot of mysteries that have come up. You know, you'll hear about ICE intercepting a undocumented person as they're dropping their kids off at school. And we've always kind of scratched our heads and said, how do they know that they're there? What was the tip off? But certainly that is consistent with license plate readers, but we won't necessarily know because a lot of times license plate readers are left out of police reports, left out of official court records, and often that's by design by the main vendor here who has law enforcement agencies sign non-disclosure agreements that prevent them from talking to the press candidly.
So you mentioned there's a vendor here. Let's talk a little bit about them. I think one of the companies is Vigilant Solutions. They're a private company that ICE is allegedly buying this license plate data from. What data are they buying and where do they get this data from?
So Vigilant Solutions operates a cloud service for license plate readers. It, number one, collects data on its own through those tow trucks that I mentioned before. And that usually accounts for something like 2/3 of the data that it has in its database. But then law enforcement agencies are able to share with each other through Vigilant system. And that's kind of an opt-in, you know, whether the agency wants to share it or maybe they don't know they're sharing it, they just have a setting mischecked. But ICE is able to access all of Vigilant's private data that it's collected, as well as select law enforcement agencies. And that means somebody from ICE is able to sit down at a terminal, put in a license plate, and suddenly get information, you know, going years and years back about where that vehicle has been seen. And they can also use that to tell them what vehicles are often seen within proximity to each other. They have the capabilities often to put in an address and see location, you know, see visitors to that location. So you can imagine that if you put in the address of, say, an immigrant, a health center that gives services to immigrants, or a legal center that provides legal services to immigrants, that you could use that to unveil an entire social network of people in that community.
And one of the things that, Dave, that we hear often from law enforcement that use technologies like this is that this is meant to keep people safe, that it's meant to find, for example, stolen cars, for example, or that it's meant to give out tickets to people who are running red lights. I mean, is there a way for this technology to be used for its positive purposes and also not used as a surveillance tool?
I mean, certainly there are ways to have a very limited program. You know, we look at hot list, as they're called. That is a predetermined list of vehicles that you're looking for. So you could put a list of stolen vehicles together, and then as cars are passing by them, maybe you get an alert about these specific vehicles without having to collect information on everyone. And that's the thing about license plate readers. I think it's something like 99.5% of the license plates that are collected are not involved or even suspected remotely of being related to a crime at the time they're collected. So the question is, why are they holding on to that data? And usually the reason is that law enforcement wants to hold on to this data in case someday down the line, maybe even years later, you commit a crime, they can turn this into a time machine and spin back to see everywhere that you visited.
Dave Moss is a senior investigative researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thanks for joining us, Dave.
Thanks for having me. Always good to be here.
Order! Order!
That's John Bercow, Speaker of the House of Commons, last Wednesday, trying to keep the UK Parliament under control. British lawmakers were trying yet again to iron out a Brexit deal ahead of the March 29th deadline.
The legal default in UK and EU law remains that the UK will leave the EU without a deal unless something else is agreed.
That's Prime Minister Theresa May also speaking on Wednesday. So far, May has been unsuccessful in getting lawmakers to agree on a way out. Joining me now from the UK is William Booth, London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. William, welcome to The Takeaway.
Nice to be here.
So this has been a long, it feels like the longest breakup I've witnessed so far. What actually happened last Wednesday, William?
And you're right, this is just the longest, most painful divorce ever to watch. Last week, there was a couple of things happened. There was a second vote on Theresa May's Brexit deal, and that was defeated. The first time her deal was introduced some weeks back, it was a humiliating defeat. And the last week was a very humbling defeat. She keeps getting clobbered.
Now, this is the second time, as you mentioned, that a Brexit deal has been voted on. What is the tension here between what May is presenting and what keeps getting pushed back on?
That's a great question, and that's kind of the foundational question about Brexit. The problem with Brexit for getting Brexit done is that the UK is divided right down the middle. I'm talking about the people. Forget the Parliament for one second. I mean, Scotland voted against Brexit. Northern Ireland voted against Brexit. It was just England and Wales went for Brexit, and even there, it wasn't overwhelming. So the country is split. Leave, remain, leave, remain. They can't really decide, and people haven't really moved very much one way or the other. And then you bring this challenge into the Parliament. The Parliament kind of leans more, let's stay, right? Most of those lawmakers probably supported staying. Theresa May certainly supported staying. She campaigned for it. So the source of this calamity is hopeless division. That's why it's so hard. That's why our British cousins look so ridiculous to us in the United States right now. They're going nuts.
What about other EU member states? What is their role in all this, if any?
The remaining members of the EU have been remarkably consistent and patient with Britain as it goes through this, through the gnashes of this terrible divorce. And so what they're saying is, Please get your act together. Please, for Lord's sake, tell us what you want, and maybe we'll give you, you know, as much time as you need to sort it out. But you can't leave the club, right, and have all the goodies of the club. And that's what Britain has traditionally wanted. It's called having your cake and eating it too. And there's even a Brexit word for it now called cakeism. So Britain wants sort of to do both things, and it can't. And the EU patiently reminds it of this and keeps pointing at its watch and saying, you know, hurry up, dear, we've got to go. You know, the party's ending, and Britain keeps diddling around. And I mean, the EU doesn't want to crash out with no deal. That's not good for anybody. So they're likely to be as patient as possible, as they have been. But we are coming up to some harder deadline.
William Booth is the London bureau chief for The Washington Post. Since we recorded this interview, there's been an update that adds yet another wrinkle to the future of Brexit. Parliament was supposed to vote on May's deal for a third time this week, but the Speaker of the House of Commons has invoked a rule that prevents that vote from taking place, at least for now. Had everything Silicon Valley wanted. A charismatic female founder who dropped out of Stanford, prestigious board members like Henry Kissinger and James Mattis, a bold new invention that was going to change the world, the technology to run hundreds of medical tests with a single drop of blood. In 2015, Theranos was valued at $9 billion, which led Forbes to name Holmes the youngest female self-made billionaire in the United States.
This is what happens when you work to change things, and first they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world.
But the technology didn't work, and an investigation by the Wall Street Journal revealed the company was built on lies. Today, Theranos doesn't exist. Holmes and her number two, Sunny Balwani, are facing federal fraud charges. And the story of her spectacular rise and fall exposed the dark side of the Silicon Valley startup generating machine. Elizabeth Holmes is also the subject of a new documentary that airs tonight on HBO. But we're turning to the man who first exposed the lies. John Carreyrou is the investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal who broke the story back in 2015. John, great to have you on the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, wow, that's a big story to break. What was captivating to you about this from the beginning?
She came on my radar in late 2014 when I read a profile of her in the New Yorker magazine. And she had actually become quite famous in Silicon Valley and beyond over the previous year. She'd graced the cover of Fortune magazine, and she, as you mentioned, she was really seen as the second coming of Steve Jobs, as a female version of Steve Jobs. But in the New Yorker profile, I noticed the ambitious and the big claims she was making, and I also noticed the main conceit of the story, of her story, which was that she had dropped out with no medical training and supposedly gone on to revolutionize, you know, a branch of medical science, namely blood testing. And I'd covered healthcare and medicine for a bunch of years, and I knew that you need formal training to add value, often, you know, medical school, PhD, years of research. And so that struck me as very odd. That was the first thing that made me suspicious about her.
So you start on this path. It's 2015. You publish your first story. What's the reaction? What was the first story you published?
Well, the first story took actually 9 months to report.
And it was clear that we understand that, because that's something that I think journalists, non-journalists don't get, right? How long it takes to get this. Yeah.
It was challenging. I had to make contact with former employees who had signed non-disclosure agreements and who were being threatened by lawyers behind the scenes. And the company also, before publication, waged a very strong counterattack. So we finally published the story in mid-October 2015, and you actually played a clip of Elizabeth Holmes's reaction. She went on Jim Cramer's show, Mad Money, on CNBC that evening. And I think her quote was, you know, this is what happens when you change the world. People fight back, and then eventually they're proven wrong. And of course, we were not proven wrong, because over the course of the ensuing, you know, 6 months to a year, regulators stepped in, inspected Theranos facilities, issued reports that corroborated our reporting and verified that the blood testing was inaccurate, that most of the blood tests were not even performed on Theranos technology. They were being performed on Siemens machines, on third-party machines made by the German conglomerate Siemens.
I want to talk a little bit about the media here and its role. Were you threatened at any point when you were doing the reporting? I know that when investigative reporters do this kind of work, it can be a little dangerous.
I was threatened with litigation by the company and by its outside counsel, David Boies, as was my employer, The Wall Street Journal. My confidential sources were threatened. One of the corroborating sources was a young man by the name of Tyler Schultz, whose grandfather is the former Secretary of State, George Schultz, who happened to be on the board of Theranos. He was ambushed by two Theranos lawyers at his grandfather's house. Another confidential source was confronted in the parking lot of her new employer and also threatened with litigation and given an ultimatum. The COO of the company, the number two executive of the company, who was Elizabeth Holmes's boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, flew to Phoenix, which was the main area where they had rolled out the Theranos blood tests in Walgreens stores, and showed up at the offices of doctors who had spoken to me on the record about discrepancies they'd found in their patients' tests and threatened them and tried to get them to sign written statements recanting what they had told me on the record.
I guess the main question, and a lot of folks want to know the answer to this question, is how? How could you get to that level that she got to and just essentially lie about the technology, lie about what it was meant to do? Like, how do you get to that point in Silicon Valley or anywhere? I mean, is it that hungry for a story that it forgets everything else, or was there something else at play here?
Well, she wasn't a Bernie Madoff in the sense that she premeditated a long con right when she dropped out in 2003. I think she really did want to be an entrepreneur. She really did have this vision of a portable blood testing device that would do a bunch of tests off a tiny pinprick of blood. She went about raising money, hiring
employees.
How did
she raise money for something that wasn't?
Well, I mean, that's the way it goes in Silicon Valley. At the very early stage, when a young founder is founding a company, you know, VCs are making a bet. In fact, in tonight's documentary on HBO, you'll see Tim Draper, the famous Silicon Valley VC who cut Elizabeth Holmes her first $1 million check, says that, you know, he invests in a guy and a cat, I think is what he says. And so, in other words, he goes with his gut feeling about the entrepreneur. And actually, people like Draper and Ellison, who were among the early investors, were not the investors who were defrauded. The investors who were defrauded are the investors who came 10 years in, 11 years in, and they're the ones to whom Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani made representations that weren't true. At that point, the company was more than a decade old, and they represented to these investors that they had achieved the vision, when in fact they had not. The prototypes were actually machines that didn't work at all. And Elizabeth and Sonny lied to these investors and told them that the machines worked and, in fact, even staged demos that were fake demos where the prospective investors would come in and their finger would be pricked, the blood would be put in the machine, and then they'd be ushered out and told this is going to take a little while. And then the blood sample would be taken out of the prototype and taken to the lab and tested by a lab associate at the bench by hand.
What was it about Elizabeth Holmes specifically that made her so intoxicating for all of the? I mean, she's, you know, attractive, white woman, dropped out of Stanford. Were all those things in the mix here? And if so, what's next for her? Does she stand to, you know, do time for what she did?
She's very smart, very charismatic, and she believed in her vision, and she believed she was going to get there eventually. It didn't matter so much in her mind that it didn't work yet. She figured that if she could maintain the fiction that it did work now and she would get there eventually, everything would be okay and no one would be the wiser. In terms of the consequences she faces very real consequences. Now she's been indicted. She and her ex-boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, have been indicted on 11 counts of wire fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud. And they're facing a criminal trial potentially as early as late this year or first quarter of next year, that there's going to be a status conference in the case in mid-April, and the judge may set a trial date then. They face up to 20 years in prison if convicted.
What, if anything, has Silicon Valley and its investors learned from this? Or, I mean, do we stand to see similar fraud in the future?
I'd like to think that Silicon Valley has learned a lesson. The main one in my mind is that you can't apply the fake it till you make it Silicon Valley playbook that is often applied in the software industry to healthcare and to medicine, or for that matter, to any endeavor or field where lives are at stake. Has Silicon Valley really learned its lesson? I don't know. I hear a lot of people say that Theranos was an outlier, that it wasn't representative of the Valley because sophisticated venture funds weren't the ones that invested in the company. And while that's true, the last round of investors were billionaires, I think what enabled Elizabeth Holmes to exist and to thrive is Silicon Valley's culture. And one of the features of that culture is this myth of the brilliant young founder who can see around corners, all-knowing, can never do wrong. I think we owe that myth to Steve Jobs, unfortunately. And it's a very popular notion in Silicon Valley. And I think she rode that wave, and she really benefited from it.
And what about the media? I know your work was really exposing what was happening here. But did the media have a role in building her up?
It did. And probably the reporters who wrote profiles of her and who gave her a lot of airtime should have been more skeptical and should have done more research. But in the case of at least two of them, and I'm thinking of Fortune Magazine's Roger Parloff and then the guy who wrote the New Yorker profile, Ken Auletta, they were outright lied to when they were given interviews by Elizabeth Holmes. And so it's hard to fault a journalist when that journalist is being bald-faced, lied to.
John Carreyrou is the investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal who broke the story back in 2015, and his book on Theranos is called Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing.
Or politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.